Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is podcast number 61 for Tuesday, August 3rd, 2010. I'll be your host this week. My name is David O'Brien, and with me is...
Dominic Rabier.
And unfortunately, we are missing two of our co-hosts this week. Ben and David Liu are off traveling around the world. Hopefully they'll be able to join us next week, though. As usual, we have three stories for you, including new DMCA exemptions for the anti-circumvention provisions. The Fifth Circuit has also come out with an interesting decision regarding the anti-circumvention provisions of the DMCA. And finally, a new privacy lawsuit that's all about flash cookies. So, diving right into it, since our first two stories are about the anti-circumvention provisions of the DMCA, it would probably be useful to give a little background on what exactly those are. The anti-circumvention provisions are located in Section 1201 of the Copyright Act, and there are two important subsections that I want to draw your attention to, and of course we'll provide a link in the show notes to the statutory language if you want to check that out. Now these two subsections are A and B, and those are both lowercase letters. And within these two subsections, there are four main prohibitions contained within these two subsections. Now, subsection A1 and A2 provide two different things. First is that A1 prohibits the circumvention of an access control, and A2 prohibits the manufacturing, importing, offering to the public, providing or traffic in any product, service, or device designed to circumvent an access control. So those are two separate prohibitions there. And in subsection B, subsection B is a little bit different than A, and it has a prohibition against manufacturing, developing devices, services, products, or that are designed to circumvent a protection afforded by a technological protection measure that effectively protects a right under the Copyright Act. And it's important to point out here that these prohibitions are different. We are talking about, at least in subsection A, prohibitions on circumventing things that control or restrict access rights to copyrighted works. And in subsection B, we're talking about protections afforded, and it's the difference here is that we're talking about access controls and copy controls in subsection B. And that might be a little bit more relevant in our discussion on our second story, which is all about the Fifth Circuit's recent opinion. Now, to understand what all the controversy is about here, I mean, when we talk about anti-circumvention, it goes hand in hand with discussions about DRM. And what we're talking about, again, is what amounts to digital locks. These are the software and sometimes hardware protections that manufacturers and content providers are placing on things like their digital music files, their software, in order to prevent people from easily copying it and offering it to other people on the internet. So the controversy here, though, is has to do with whether or not there are some sort of additional rights created in Section 1201. And what's interesting about it is that many legal experts seem to think that the fair use defenses might not apply to it, meaning that if you circumvent an access control, you can't claim fair use as a defense to that circumvention, and you might still be liable for some violation under the Copyright Act. Now, the problem is that when we usually talk about violations of the Copyright Act, we're talking about infringements, but there's no mention of infringements in Section 1201 anywhere. And if you look back to the provision on fair use, which is in Section 107, and it says that if you violate any of the rights in Section 106, which contain the very traditional and typical rights that are afforded to a copyright owner, including the prohibition on distribution, copying, and the creation of derivative works. If you violate any of those, so long as you are using it as a fair use, the Section 107 says it is not an infringement of copyright. And what's important about that little language there is that Section 1201, the anti-circumvention section, does not say anything about it being an infringement of copyright if you circumvent some sort of access control or circumventing copy protections. So in other words, you cannot, it seems that, at least on the statutory language, you cannot have a fair use defense if you are accused of a circumvention of either an access control or a copy control. That's sort of the bottom line here. Now getting back to whether there's some sort of additional right that is granted under the anti-circumvention provisions, what this is talking about is whether you can read the anti-circumvention provision to be some sort of additional violation under the Act if you circumvent, even if you do not ultimately conduct any type of infringing activity that would otherwise impinge on those more traditional rights under the Copyright Act, that is the prohibitions on copying, distributing, and creating derivative works. Now, some people read this to mean that if you do violate the anti-circumvention provision, you can be held liable just under that provision, even without any other infringing violation under the Copyright Act. And that's something that we'll discuss more in the next story. But more important to our discussion in this story, which is all about the new exemptions which were enacted, while Congress had enacted the DMCA, and in particular the anti-circumvention section, they realized that there is a risk that copyright owners might try to use the anti-circumvention provisions to limit the general public's ability to make fair uses of works. And in order to sort of remedy that situation, the anti-circumvention section requires the Library of Congress, in conjunction with the U.S. Copyright Office, to meet every 3 years and enact new exemptions which would otherwise prohibit or prevent the fair use of copyrighted works by the general public. And that's what happened this week, and this is our first story here. The Library of Congress came out, they have now enacted their new exemptions. There are 6 exemptions which were enacted this year, and by the way, every time the Library of Congress and the Copyright Office meet, they also have to reissue rules that they had issued 3 years ago. Every time that they enact these new exemptions, the old ones expire, so if there's any that they want to continue to keep, they have to reenact them. And that was part of what was going on this week. But there are 2 new exemptions which were probably the most important out of all of them that were issued this week. And going out of order here, so I'm not actually reading these out of the release by the Copyright Office, but there is now an exemption for jailbreaking your cell phone in order to run unsigned application. This basically means softmodding the device to permit some type of interoperability for applications or other types of software that the manufacturer of the cell phone or the manufacturer of the operating system itself would not otherwise allow you to do with some sort of technological protection measure that would prohibit either the access or copy protection of the operating system that's underlying it. And the second big one which came out is that now there is an exemption for amateur video makers to decrypt or break the content scramble system on DVDs in order to create new mashups or somehow make underlying fair uses of a DVD, like a film on a DVD, and post them on YouTube. And this last one here stands sort of in stark contrast to Hollywood's previous view that any kind of ripping of a DVD is a violation of the Copyright Act. But I have to admit, before we really get into the more substantive discussions, I felt, at least for the purposes of the jailbreaking one, which seemed to be one of the exemptions that people were pretty excited about, that it just wasn't that exciting to me, because I never really thought that Apple would really go after people for jailbreaking their individual iPhones.
Nonetheless, the threat sort of loomed over people, though. I mean, because Apple can remotely brick phones.
Right, that's true. There are some big caveats to, at least for the jailbreaking exemption, and that's although the U.S. Copyright Office has released these for the anti-circumvention provision, this has no effect whatsoever on contract law. So while you're using your iPhone, you still have to agree to the iOS end-user license agreement, which also prohibits this activity that would where you modify basically the underlying software. And also their warranty still applies, and if you if they at least can prove that you have done something to modify the software on your phone, they can void your warranty over this still. Did any of these new exemptions come as a surprise to you, Dominic?
Not in particular, because a lot of them had been proposed. The Librarian of Congress actually made a request for comments on proposed exemptions about maybe several months ago, not quite a year ago, and they listed some of these as proposed exemptions. Some others too. I think there were 30 in all. Some of them didn't make it, but I mean, I had seen them as proposed exemptions, so I'm happy to see them now as actual exemptions.
Now, the next important thing to discuss about the new exemptions is exactly what it is that they're exempting. And if you look at the release by the Copyright Office, you'll note in the first paragraph it states that these exemptions apply only to 1201A1. And that's interesting, especially if you consider what we just talked about a little while ago, and that was the different prohibitions under A1 and A2, as well as the prohibitions under subsection B. And you'll note that subsection A1 really only applies to basically the personal jailbreaking. In other words, it's still a violation if you create some sort of device, meaning if you're a software developer and you create some software that enables a person to basically affect the jailbreaking of the iPhone, then you're still going to be liable even despite these exemptions. At least
Yeah, I
on
see
my
it.
read of this. Yeah, on my read of this, what is still prohibited here is
It's
the
distributing the stuff to circumvent it.
yes. So it's like saying basically you can circumvent it yourself, but you can't, no one can tell you how to circumvent it. That's still unlawful under these new
Although the
exemptions.
next story that we'll talk about may offer a way out because of work protected under this title. But we'll get into that in a bit.
Right. So, I mean, I think the two most important takeaways from this is that, at least under to my knowledge, Apple has never sued anybody for violating their or for violating this particular section of the Copyright Act for jailbreaking their phone. So, I don't think that there's ever been any indication that they would. It seems like it would be horrible PR if they did. So, the fact that the Library of Congress has finally enacted this exemption, at least for the next 3 years, kind of seems like a moot point to me. And it only applies to cellular devices, basically, or wireless phones. And it does not apply to, at least as far as I've read in the exemptions, any other devices. So that means if you have an iPod Touch, it would seem that you can't jailbreak your iPod Touch, but you could jailbreak your iPhone.
But is an iPod Touch a wireless telephone handset? I mean, you can run Skype on it.
Yeah, that's a good point. You have some sort of Wi-Fi connectivity. You could run an application like Skype over it.
And that's a
I guess
wireless telephone, right?
it
In the
would seem
broad
to be
reading of it.
so. That's a good argument. I obviously the other half of that is that it's not a device which was intended to be just a phone by itself, which would be what the iPhone is kind of like too.
Right, but the iPhone isn't intended to just be a phone either.
True. Do you think
To play devil's advocate a bit with you.
so do you think that this is not just some shoddy drafting here, or was that actually meant to encompass some more devices, or at least more Apple devices, like the iPod Touch?
I mean, I think it's an open question because, I mean, computer programs that enable used wireless telephone handsets. I mean, are you reading two or three? Because there's one that basically interoperability, the other is to change your network. The network provision basically seems that, like it's something that connects to some sort of wireless network. Wireless
So,
telecommunications network. And a Wi-Fi network probably doesn't fall under a wireless telecommunications network. So that seems to then. But I mean, it's a separate provision, so should we use that knowledge to interpret the first provision? Do you see
I
what
don't
I'm
think so. I
saying?
think they can be read separately. I
Yeah, they
do.
can be read separately.
So, just to clarify what Dominic is talking about here, in the actual release from the Copyright Office, there are two separate provisions in the exemptions which relate to wireless telephones. The second of which is the one that we've been talking about here, the jailbreaking one. And the third is all about unlocking cellular devices and enabling them to work on other carriers' networks so long as the carrier would allow such a device to operate on their network. And that's actually one that has existed since 2006, I believe, and that was reenacted in this round of exemptions as well. Like if the carrier would permit, say, an iPhone 4, say someone is able to successfully unlock their iPhone 4 so that it no longer runs on the AT&T service but is capable of running on the T-Mobile service. This exemption, if there was some sort of access control or some other type of technological measure which was controlling the access to the underlying software, I think that's what this would exempt if you were unlocking the phone in that manner. I don't think that it 2 and 3 are meant to read together, though. So it looks like this was a pretty big win, at least for a lot of people who are interested in seeing some of these new exemptions be added to the law. And there are some other interesting ones in here. Like we mentioned before, you have motion pictures on DVDs that are lawfully made and acquired and are protected by the CSS system. So basically, if you wanted to decrypt the CSS in order to make a copy on your hard drive of a DVD that you've already lawfully purchased, to make some sort of fair use of it, that's now permissible under the Act. But again, that does not affect the B2 provision as far as I can read in the code itself. So it's still unlawful to distribute or create software that's capable of doing that. So that's an interesting quirk to this as well. And you also have another exemption that relates to video games and basically the DRM encryption, which protects the video games. And this new exemption here is just about good faith testing for investigating or correcting security flaws or vulnerabilities. And let's see, finally, here we have two more, which relate to computer programs protected by dongles that prevent access due to malfunction or damage, and which are obsolete. So if you have, if it's required of you to use a dongle in order to access a computer program of some sort, if your dongle breaks or if it's so old that it's obsolete and you can no longer get a new version of it, if you're able and capable of breaking the whatever access control measures that have been put over the software itself, it's no longer a violation of the anti-circumvention provision to do so.
That makes sense.
And finally, here we have our very last one, which is all about literary works which were distributed in ebook format when all existing ebook editions of the work, including digital text editions, contain access controls that prevent the enabling of either the book's read aloud function or the screen readers that render the text into a specialized format. So, some interesting things in there. I think most people were interested in the DVD stuff and the iPhone jailbreaking stuff as well. But this leads us right into our next story.
Yes. So the Fifth Circuit has ruled that basically, let me give you a little background of the case. There's this company out there, MGE, and they make UPS power backup devices. In other words, if the power goes out, your computer will still run if you're hooked up to a MGE UPS power device. And the code in order to run this power device is you need basically a physical external dongle attached to it, a piece of hardware basically that the company provides you. And that way they can limit piracy by restricting the number of these physical dongles that they hand out. So if you don't have the right dongle, your hardware won't work and the software on it won't work. So some hackers figured out how to bypass this dongle system, not too hard in terms of reverse engineering what it was looking for and providing it with something similar, a bit of ingenuity, if you will. And another company, PMI, obtained these bypass software bypass, if you will, from an unknown source. MGE sued PMI. PMI happened to have been bought out by GE in the meanwhile. MGE sued PMI for copyright infringement, misappropriation of trade secrets, unfair competition, conversion, and DMCA violations. So, district court jury gave MGE $4.6 million in various damages, but the DMCA claim got dismissed, so MGE appealed because they really wanted the DMCA claim. And so they went to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And what the Fifth Circuit says is, wait a second, what's copyrighted here? You are basically using a security dongle attached to hardware. They're basically replicating the functionality of this dongle by reverse engineering it in software and making the hardware think that there's a dongle hooked up even though there isn't. But what's the copyright violation? What copyright is being violated? And they basically say that the DMCA's 1201A, which we just talked about, no person shall circumvent a technological measure that effectively controls access to work protected under this title, with emphasis added there, protected under this title. The Fifth Circuit said, hey, sure, you circumvented a technological measure. Sure, it effectively controls access to a work, but your work isn't protected under this title because it's not under copyright. And they said basically that using that definition of access, that anything that's protected is automatically under copyright, is too broad, and it basically would eviscerate fair use. And they say that the DMCA isn't that broad. It's only there to protect copyright owners. It's not there to make all technological forms of protection impossible, even when those technological protections don't protect from copyright violation. Does that sound like a decent summary to you, Dave?
Yeah, very good summary. This was very much a technical reading of the statute, and I think since DMCA was enacted, a lot of people have questioned whether the anti-circumvention provisions were actually creating new rights under the Copyright Act, or whether that this was just sort of giving copyright owners a new way to protect their works. And it looks like the Fifth Circuit here has reached the latter in terms of those two options. And if you look at the language itself, it is a very close read between the two. You know, no person shall circumvent a technological measure that effectively controls access to a work protected under this title. Now, the phrase "this title" is referring to Title 17 of the U.S. Code, which is the entire Copyright Act. So, you know, what's interesting here is that the other language that's important in that sentence that is all about a technological measure that effectively controls access to a work. Now, there's no real question, I think, that the software that was in dispute here, it was a cracked version that was capable of being run without the dongle. It is software, and it was capable of being protected under the Copyright Act, and in fact, it was. And this provision seems to say that if you have a technological measure that effectively controls the access, if you circumvent that, you're in violation of the DMCA. And that's one read here, but the way that the court read this is that there's no affirmative rights that are actually being created under the anti-circumvention provision. What this actually refers to, at least in the court's view, is that there has to, if you're going to have a violation of the circumvention provision, it has to ultimately be about a violation of copyright law. And since the dongle only really controlled the initial access to the work, not, you know, it only controlled a person who, say, logged onto the computer and then was able to access the software without the dongle, it didn't actually control anything that had to do with the copying or redistribution of the program itself. Therefore, you cannot have a violation of the anti-circumvention provision. Now, in my opinion, you know, I think this is such a close read. It's really difficult to say what was actually intended when, you know, the legislators wrote this particular section in the anti-circumvention portion of the DMCA. And it's a little refreshing, though, to see the Fifth Circuit's view on this and to take it to mean that, you know, you have to ultimately have some sort of violation of the Copyright Act. One of the you have to be infringing on somebody's right that's effectively granted to them under the Copyright Act before you can have a violation of the anti-circumvention provision.
Yeah. This has implications for other software, like there used to be software called Real DVD, released by Real Player, or by Real Networks, the makers of Real Player. And basically, if you had a DVD, you could put it into Real DVD and rip it to your hard drive so that you don't need to go looking around your house for the disc. You can just play it right off your hard drive. And the MPAA sued Real Networks pretty hard over this. And the U.S. District Court in Northern California actually came down in favor of them last fall, and gave Real Networks a temporary injunction. But this case could potentially change how that product or similar products will exist. Probably means Real DVD won't be coming back because Real Networks already settled with the MPAA and terminated the product, but it means that future products could potentially have hope because fair use is not something to be protected from. Like, if I own a DVD and I want to rip it to my hard drive, and I'm just watching it out of convenience that, hey, I'm going to be traveling with a laptop, say, and I'd rather put five movies on my hard drive than carry five DVDs with me. That seems like that's perfectly fair use, and it's not a violation of copyright law. It's not a violation of a work protected under this title, because it's not protected in that sense, because it's not protected from fair use. That's one possible reading.
Yeah, we'll have to see. I mean, how people ultimately interpret this. One big question that I have is, I think I ultimately agree with the conclusion that the Fifth Circuit has reached here, but I'm not sure if I completely agree with some portions of their reasoning. In subsection A, what you have is under the definitions of what it means to circumvent an access control. To circumvent a technological measure means to descramble a scrambled work, to decrypt an encrypted work, or otherwise to avoid, bypass, remove, deactivate, or impair a technological measure without the authority of the copyright owner. And then you have capital B, a technological measure effectively controls access to a work if the measure in the ordinary course of its operation requires the application of information or a process or treatment with the authority of the copyright owner to gain access to the work. Neither of those definitions in at least in subsection A had any reference really to the need for some sort of violation of a copyright owner's ultimate rights, which are granted under the other portions of the Copyright Act. And if you continue to read that, really this section is granting some additional right in addition to those the standard rights which are granted to a copyright owner. In that sense, you could have a violation of the anti-circumvention provision, even if there's no further violations as a matter of copyright law overall. I think that there is actually a tenable argument here that under subsection A, what's happening in the DMCA is that the DMCA is granting some sort of right to the copyright owner to control who can access it and who can view it. And that is completely distinct from the ability to copy it or otherwise provide some sort of or do some sort of activity which would otherwise violate their traditional rights under the concepts of infringement in Section 106. So again, we're talking about the right to copy, distribute, and make derivative works of a copyrighted work. And because of that, I think that what the court has done here is they've taken a strong position that A really is only about access as it relates to an ultimate act of infringement, and it's not a right on its own. I am confused when I read this. I mean, it's just not clear to me. So I think that there is, in terms of legal arguments here, you've got a hard decision to make if you're a judge on what the correct way to read this statute is. This might just be a great example of very poor drafting because it's not clear exactly what subsection A is actually giving a copyright owner in terms of rights.
So our last story, moving on, involves flash cookies. I actually was unfamiliar with the concept of a flash cookie before I came across the story, so I'm going to give you a quick summary of what it is. Basically, Adobe Flash, which is pretty much used everywhere, has storage space that you can write to as a web application. So if you load Flash, the Flash can store a little bit of information and using a cookie basically inside Flash, if you will. It's a little different than the HTTP header cookie, but it's the same sort of concept. So what does this mean? This means that if you are running with cookies off, but you have Flash enabled, and websites are using that storage space in Flash to store information, they can still track you because they're keeping their information in Adobe Flash's storage space as opposed to the cookies that you have disabled. So these Flash cookies or zombie cookies are basically so the way they work as zombies is basically the information in the Flash cookie is then read back by the website, which then writes out another cookie or acts as if you had the cookie that you thought you deleted still there. So researchers at UC Berkeley actually documented this and were like, wait, where are these cookies coming back from? And that's how this all came across. So someone filed a lawsuit in the U.S. District Court in San Francisco against a bunch of websites on the internet, MTV, ESPN, MySpace, Hulu, ABC, NBC, and Scribd, all of which use these Flash cookies to recreate cookies that users have deleted. They are saying this is basically covert online surveillance, and they're looking for class action. The person filing this lawsuit is Joseph Malley. He's a privacy activist lawyer. He has been involved in the lawsuit over Facebook over its Beacon program. He got a $9.5 million settlement there, and a settlement with Netflix over the Netflix Prize after Netflix imperfectly made its data anonymous, that it wasn't as anonymous as it thought, because you could still basically reverse engineer based on patterns to see who people were. So this guy has some credentials, and he's not just some random guy suing all these companies. So he's saying, hey guys, you can't be doing this. It's against the law. This is a violation of people's privacy. It's a violation of hacking, eavesdropping laws, and it also violates state and federal fair trade laws. So a little more on the Flash cookie. Websites can actually store 100 kilobytes of information inside the plugin, which is a lot bigger than a cookie can be. If you use Pandora, you might see that Pandora actually uses that Flash storage space to preload songs. So when you're listening to a song, it'll fill up that extra space with the start of the next song so that you can get a smooth listening experience. So that seems like a legitimate use of the cookie. But other sites are using this to basically store your user ID or some other information that they've collected about you so that they can track you even if you have your cookies off. The objective that Mr. Malley has is that he wants the court to order them to stop doing this, as well as damages for the class that have been injured by this. It's interesting to note that browser controls completely don't have anything to do with Flash cookies. There's no way to turn them off for a regular user. Like, you can disable cookies in your browser, you can't disable Flash cookies. I'm not even sure. Unless you're using an add-on for Firefox. Basically, it's not something that's enabled in the default privacy settings. So it's an interesting lawsuit. I'm not sure whether it'll be successful, but it certainly made me aware of Flash cookies that I haven't been aware of. And the add-on for Firefox, in case you're interested, is called Better Privacy, and that will block or delete Flash cookies.
Do you know at all if these companies can see each other's data that they're storing within the Flash cookie itself?
I imagine that it's domain specific somewhat, but if companies use a shared advertising domain like DoubleClick or something, not that DoubleClick does this, but for example, if they're serving ads from the same host, then that host can save that information and perhaps pass it along on the back end.
This could be the new version of the privacy issues that we might see, at least in the future, people tracking basically your every move around the domains on the internet, and even a little bit more than that, they could probably learn something about the type of content that you're viewing, what you're searching for in some circumstances, and if there's no effective way for you to control Flash cookies just through your standard browser options, which I think a lot of people would already say are complex as is, and they don't necessarily give you an easy way to control all of your cookie settings, then that this could be the future of what we see in terms of marketing companies tracking people people as they move around and learning more insight into the types of people that visit their website.
Yeah, so actually they can't, it's domain specific, so you can't share what's called a flashcard. Ah. Technical name is a local shared object, and it is domain specific basically because of flash. So if you're at example.com, you can't read cookies by example2.com. You can only read cookies from your own domain. But that still doesn't get around the problem of advertisers using a single domain on multiple sites and sharing that information.
Yep, that's true. And it looks here that there is the Firefox extension that you mentioned earlier is called Better Privacy, and that does allow you some sort of control to view and delete these locally shared objects or flash cookies. So on the merits of the suit itself, do you have any thoughts on what might be the most successful claim under it?
It's hard to say. I can't say I've seen any suits about something quite like this. I personally think that it'll probably settle, which is a safe bet usually because 90% or something of all lawsuits settle. The thing that probably really is the strongest argument he'll have is websites were using these flash cookies as backup, if you will. So they give you a cookie, they also give you a flash cookie. You delete your cookie. They're like, hey, you deleted your cookie. Oh, let's look in the flash. Oh, here's a flash cookie. We'll recreate the cookie. This is where the idea of zombie cookies or respawning cookies came from. And this is where the UC Berkeley researchers first were like, what? Where is this coming from? So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's probably the scummiest thing, if you will. Like, that's the most suspicious thing. That's the most wrong thing about it, in that if a user said they don't want your data, and you're noticing that they've deleted the data that you told them they don't want, that they told you that you don't want, and then you're putting it back using this secret flash cookie that you created without their express consent and probably without their actual knowledge, that's pretty sketchy. And in fact, that's probably sketchy enough to be a violation of at least fair trade laws, but potentially even eavesdropping and hacking laws. Although, I'm not sure about the hacking, but I'm not that familiar with the actual text of eavesdropping and hacking laws, but just on the face of it, it doesn't seem like it would be hacking or eavesdropping per se, but certainly a fair trade violation. Like, we don't want companies doing this sort of thing.
Just thinking off the top of my head here, not actually looking at the language of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, I believe it's all about unauthorized access to a computer system, but you also need to have damages that are equal to or in excess of $5,000, so that might be a difficult thing to prove under this.
But he's doing it as a class action, so maybe he can, can he aggregate the damages or no?
A great question. Again, I don't know. I kind of doubt,
though. Sure, it
has
to be each, right? It has to, at least one member of the class has to qualify on their own, is what I remember from what I learned about class action law. You can't just be like, hey, if we put this all together. So.
Those laws are more typically used in the context of companies than they are for individuals, because you have usually like a security auditor who comes in and actually looks at whatever damage was actually caused by the alleged hacker, and for the purposes of calculating the damages under the act, a lot of people just used what resources they had to expend in order to make sure to see what the extent of the damage was caused, that the extent of the damage that was caused by the hacker that came in, and say, okay, well, since that's past $5,000, then we qualify under the act itself. Since individuals usually don't try to audit their own home computers or PCs, it's probably pretty unlikely that, you can prove the $5,000 damage under the Act.
Yeah.
So the other interesting thing about this is that, a lot of websites, actually just about every website you go to these days, has its own privacy policy, and, also, another part of the legal documents you find on the websites are the terms of service agreements as well. And those usually force you to agree to things, and I must confess myself, when I go to a website, the first thing that I do is not clicking on the terms of service agreement and the privacy policy agreement. It's often clicking on the content itself. Might we see then in the future some sort of terms of service agreement that includes language, which allows people to use these types of locally shared objects or maybe do other funky things with the cookies on your computer, even just the HTTP cookies.
You mean in terms of the website's terms of service?
Yeah, so I mean, if you're
try
forced
to get around
to
it by saying that.
Yeah,
but that's, I mean, if it's a violation of fair trade, then, like, you can't, I mean, to take a really extreme example, say you're visiting a website and you don't read the terms of service and use the website, and the terms of service say, by agreeing to use this website, you agree that you give permission for a squad of highly trained assassins to come to your house and blow your brains out. No, you can't do that. It doesn't matter whether you agree to it. It doesn't matter whether you read it and were like, oh yeah, I really want that to happen. You just can't do that. So if this is indeed a violation of fair trade or a violation of privacy and eavesdropping laws, then you can't consent out of it.
That's a good point. And yeah, I think that would likely prohibit that. But in the absence of finding that was such a violation, I mean, it might stick. It's possible. I mean, I have tons of issues with these things just because it's just usually not very obvious to the users on the site as they're browsing that they're effectively agreeing to these rather long contracts and privacy policy agreements, and some of which, you know, allow these companies to take whatever information that you input into the site's text fields and then sell it off to third parties for marketing purposes if they like. This would just be another extension of that if they were able to place you know, various types of cookies on your computer that you basically could not delete. That's pretty awful.
Well, you can actually delete them if you know what you're doing with Flash. You'd have to go into each domain settings and set the storage capacity to 0 kilobytes. I remember seeing that Flash storage slider, and I was like, what in the world is this for? A long time ago. But I never made the connection to Flash cookies, and I consider myself a decently technically sophisticated user, so...
Yeah, equally, I had no idea.
Most
absolutely
people probably
no
have no clue.
That's true. And, you know, even just the phrase Flash cookie, I don't know. That sounds like some new college craze.
Yeah. But we'll definitely keep an eye on this story. It's certainly an interesting one. And, again, Mr. Malley has a history of at least getting good settlements in terms of his privacy concerns.
I mean, you do recall, of course, the Facebook Beacon program, which was almost equally invasive in terms of sharing types of personal information, probably a little bit more egregious than this instance, but he was able to secure a large victory for that in that case as well.
Yeah.
Settlement, at least. Do you think, before we wrap this up, do you think that there's any liability on the part of Adobe here for allowing this kind of functionality? I mean, that seems kind of far-fetched to me, and I can't think of anything myself.
Probably not, because it has legitimate uses. It's not like they put this in so, oh, you want to store secret information on your users? Oh, we'll give you this feature. No, they put this in for various uses, like if you're streaming content and you want to have a buffer, then you can have a little bit of local storage for something like that. Pandora, for example, uses this legitimately. So, I mean, it's just a tool that they've made available, and the fact that some people are misusing the tool, I think it'd be highly unlikely for Adobe to have liability in this case, unless, of course, they use Flash cookies to track users on their own websites, but I don't think they have.
That's a good point. Oh, well, we will certainly keep our eye on this one.
Yep. And any other comments on any of our three stories?
No, I think I'm good.
Well, that was a pretty quiet cast. I'm Dominic Robby, and with me today was...
your only cast member, David O'Brien.
You can visit our website at technicallylegal.org. We don't use any Flash cookies, so don't worry. You can also subscribe to our podcast at the same URL. And if you have any questions on our podcast, thoughts, comments, flames, intelligent remarks, feel free to email us at podcast@technicallylegal.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at @techlegal.